Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Friday, December 7th is Pearl Harbor Day, when in 1941, a Japanese attack on American warships in Hawaii would bring the United States into World War II. The attack came as a surprise, and so Pearl Harbor also represented a huge U.S. intelligence failure, after which the country vowed never to fall so short again. But where to find the analysts, the code breakers, to keep that vow? Men were being mobilized off to war, so the military called upon women to do the job, young women right out of college. By war's end, more than 10,000 would join the effort, translating intelligence that U.S. commanders used to save American lives and win the war. Today in The Exchange, we talk with author Liza Mundy about her new book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Liza Mundy joins us from a studio in D.C. And Liza, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for your time.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So why is this, until now, Liza, an untold story?
Well, for a number of reasons. Of course, during the war, we were enormously successful in breaking Japanese and German and other enemy code systems. But during wartime, you, of course, don't want the enemy to know that you're working their code system. So this was top, top secret intelligence work during the war. The women who did it were told never to tell anybody what they had done, certainly during the war. They were told that they would be shot if they talked about the work that they did. So it was hush-hush at the time. And then after the war, they were basically told, thanks very much for your service. Now never tell anybody what you did. And they had had this really inculcated into them. And so the women never talked. They went for decades and decades listening to their husbands, you know, talk about their own war service and unable to talk about their own enormous contribution to the winning of World War II. So that's why it was untold. But it was also untold because historians writing about World War II code breaking really, for many, many years, minimized the contribution of these women who actually comprised more than half of our code breaking force.
So what about documents, Liza? From what I understand, there were some newly declassified documents that you were able to work with?
Yes, I spent several years getting documents declassified. I mean, believe it or not, a lot of material from World War II is still classified.
Wow.
This was really, you know, the dawn of our intelligence agencies. The NSA is the descendant agency of our successful World War II code breaking. The CIA was basically born during the war, and they don't want documents declassified often, you know, unless they really have to be, and unless somebody really tries. So it took me several years of knocking on the door and coming back and back, in many cases, to get these documents declassified and now posted online in most cases.
Well, what tipped you off, Liza, to this story?
So a certain amount of information had been declassified, and there was a document associated with the release of the Venona documents. That was our Russian code-breaking program. It was very, very small during the war and then became much bigger during the Cold War. And these documents had been released during the 1980s, and there was a document that mentioned that most of the people working the Venona Russian code-breaking project were women, and that many of them were school teachers, former school teachers who had been recruited during the war from the South, specifically a couple from far southwestern Virginia, which is where I'm from. And I was so intrigued by the idea of, you know, school teachers coming to Washington to break codes that I spoke to an historian at the NSA. Our federal agencies have wonderful historians. And she tipped me off to the much larger story of women coming from all over the country during the war to break any number of code systems.
Well, and you talk about in the book what a giant effort this was by the end of the war. You know, more than 10,000 women. It's really amazing. Let's start at the beginning, though, Liza. You write that Pearl Harbor represented a huge failure of American intelligence. Lots of blame to go around. Let's just hear, to put us kind of in the frame of mind, President Roosevelt addressing the nation the day after Pearl Harbor.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Okay, so there's President Roosevelt. And the word suddenly there, Liza, a lot of people have said this attack came as a complete surprise, representing, again, a failure on the part of our American intelligence agencies. So the military says, all right, we cannot let this happen again. But since there's so few young men, we'll have to take young women, we'll have to train them to be code breakers. What was the prevailing cultural attitude about this, Liza, giving these incredibly important jobs to females?
Yes. You know, I actually found, when I was doing my research, I found a document in which a light bulb moment went on over a naval bureaucrat's head. It was a document showing where they were looking for codebreakers, where they were getting their codebreakers. And it literally was typed out, new source, women's colleges. So it was this remarkable moment in American history when the U.S. military said the educated young men we would normally turn to do this high-level brain work and intelligence work are unavailable. So let's see what educated women can do. And, you know, and up until then, if you were a woman attending the Seven Sisters colleges or, you know, many fine women's colleges around the country, the only job you could expect upon graduation was school teaching. And that's great if you want to be a school teacher, but not if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. And these women had never been competed for in, you know, by employers. And all of a sudden, the Army and the Navy both start strategizing over how to compete for these women. And the Navy starts reaching out to the Seven Sisters colleges and setting up sort of pipelines and secretly calling women in. So it is it's just a massive turning point in our country's willingness to, you know, to tap this untapped talent pool.
The Seven Sisters colleges, by the way, are the colleges in Massachusetts, sort of very, I don't want to say elite, but well-regarded, established in New England.
Oh, absolutely. You know, extremely rigorous educations. These women had had math, physics, Latin, Greek, French. A fine liberal arts education was exactly the preparation that they needed to learn how to become code breakers.
Well, and I definitely want to talk to you a little bit later about the North-South thing and the Army-Navy rivalry and so forth. But just in terms of how, again, it was regarded to bring women onto these unbelievably important jobs, you write, Liza, that in one sense, some military leaders thought, you know, women might be better at this than men. Now, how come?
Well, there was the idea at the time was that women were better at low-level sort of routine work, that women were better at sitting at their desk and sort of concentrating on low-level tasks, and that a lot of code breaking, particularly at that time, was an enormous collective effort. You know, computers were only beginning to be developed, and so much of the brain work, much of which was difficult but routine, was done by people. And so the thinking was that women would be good at these repetitive tasks.
And that they wouldn't.
But there was also some concern about women's ability to keep a secret.
Right.
Because women were considered to be gossips and talkers.
So they'll be good at those sort of routine tasks. We have to worry about them chit-chatting.
Right.
But and this is not me saying it. The military leaders also said, you know, men tend to brag more about their accomplishments. So,
yes.
You know, let's worry about that,
right.
too.
Right. The thinking was that, you know, an army private or something, if he was drinking and trying to, I mean, I literally found documents. This is not me saying it. I literally found documents saying, you know, an army private, if he starts drinking, he wants to impress women, he might start bragging about the work that he does. And there was a sense, I think, that while women might be chit-chatters or whatever, that they were less likely to sort of be bragging about their work in an attempt to, you know, entice somebody romantically.
Well, and some of the efforts that the military put out to entice these women to take these jobs is really, I mean, it's interesting to look back at it with modern eyes. They wanted women, I think they said, of quality. They wanted women who could keep their lips zipped, understandable. Who were they sort of looking at as good candidates, and who were they skeptical might be right for the job?
Well, as you said, the ability to keep your lips zipped was of primary importance. When they, you know, they put out feelers, the Navy in particular had pre-existing relationships with the men's Ivy League schools. And so the Navy began reaching out to the Seven Sisters, which were considered the counterparts. And women who were good at languages, who were majoring in math or physics, women who showed what today we would call grit, that is, you know, persistence, resilience, the ability to withstand failure. They were secretly tapped by their math and astronomy professors at these schools, and they were called in one by one in secret meetings, and they were asked two questions. Do you like crossword puzzles, and are you engaged to be married? And if they answered yes to the first and no to the second, then they would be invited to take the secret correspondence course that the Navy had developed to train codebreakers. So they were, you know, they were looking for women who could keep a secret, women who were resilient, well-educated, and women who were single, women who weren't going to be following their boyfriend to training camp. And what's interesting is a lot of these women were engaged because there was enormous pressure to get engaged after Pearl Harbor. You know, the men wanted somebody home waiting for them. But many of the women lied and said they weren't engaged because whatever they were being invited to do sounded a lot more interesting than, you know, sitting around waiting to see whether their brothers and boyfriends would be okay.
Well, and the recruiters also didn't want women who might have ties to, you know, Russia or they were even suspicious of Jews. Give us a little more there, Liza.
Yes, and particularly when the Navy was even sort of thinking about this before Pearl Harbor, and they were concerned about women who had ties to any of the occupied countries, certainly any of the Axis countries, and even Jewish women, because they were concerned that they might do or say something precipitously to actually get us involved in the war. So, you know, there was a lot of paranoia on the part of the U.S. military about fifth columnists or more likely people who would be likely to engage us in the war effort. The Navy did end up recruiting Jewish women, and Jewish women certainly served in this effort. But, you know, there was a lot of, I guess, sort of trial and error. I mean, this was the dawn of our intelligence agencies, and the top brass were trying to figure out not only aptitude tests, you know, and how to test for aptitude, but who could keep a secret.
Again, the number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're talking with the author of a recent book on the story of thousands and thousands of young American women who became codebreakers in World War II, translating intelligence that U.S. commanders used to save American lives to win the war. They were involved in helping break codes surrounding a number of key battles, Midway, D-Day, and so on. We'll hear about that, and we'd love to hear from you, too. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Liza, without going into too much detail, how was code breaking done at this time? How much was automated? How much was done by hand? I saw The Imitation Game twice, which is about the British breaking of the Enigma code, the German Enigma coding machine. So how much was done by hand and how much was done by machines?
You know, almost all of it was done by hand and brain at this point. We were developing early machines. Early key punch machines could help with some sorting, numerical sorting of what were called code groups. These would be groups of numbers that generally stood for a word or a letter. So there was some early machine work going on. And of course, World War II was when we developed a lot of our early computers. But this was, if you could see the photos, I mean, the code breaking was thousands and thousands and thousands of women sitting in big rooms, the messages being passed along by conveyor belt, women running from one table to another, sitting there with pencils and graph paper and strips of paper, doing it all by hand and all by head.
And where did the information come from, and what type of information was it?
Oh, it was the locations of ships. It was the destination of supply ships that were supplying the Japanese army. One of my central characters, a school teacher from Virginia named Dot Braden, was assigned to work the Japanese supply ship effort. And this was massively important. The Japanese army was spread out all over the Pacific after Pearl Harbor, often on islands. They were being supplied by ships that were bringing them everything that we needed. We broke that code system called the Water Transport Code. It was being worked by school teachers in Washington, running from table to table to get these messages deciphered as fast as they could so that the intelligence about the whereabouts of these ships could be radioed to an American submarine commander who would be waiting when the ship appeared. And as a result of that, we sunk thousands and thousands of Japanese supply ships. It had a massive impact on the war in the Pacific. You know, and that's just one example.
Well, and it's interesting because, again, a lot of Americans saw the Imitation Game about the breaking of the code concerning the Atlantic. But these women, I mean, they broke all sorts of code, but they really focused on the Pacific, which is less known. So give us a little bit more of how challenging that was. The Pacific is a huge, huge place.
Exactly. And I should say, we also were very involved in the Atlantic effort
Sure.
and the breaking of those codes and the location of the U-boats, which was extremely important in the Atlantic. But the Pacific, as you say, it's a vaster body of water. And immediately after Pearl Harbor, when we entered the war, the British had primary code-breaking responsibility for the Atlantic, and we were helping them. But we had primary lead code-breaking responsibility for the vast Pacific, where we had just been very unpleasantly surprised. We were now sending men out there on destroyers, aircraft carriers. You know, so many lives were at stake. We couldn't let another Pearl Harbor happen again. It was an enormous responsibility, and we had to figure out, you know, where do you locate these ships? I mean, how do you know if another attack is coming? And also, how do we locate the Japanese naval ships and the Japanese supply ships, you know, to target them and sink them? And that's what the code breaking was aimed to do. You know, it was also supporting our effort to take back islands that had been captured, you know, Guam and the Philippines and these other islands, this land that we had lost. We wanted to take that back. But so we had to find the ships. We had to find the supply ships, and we had to, you know, generate intelligence for amphibious landings and our, you know, attempt to push back.
And very stressful work for these women.
Enormously stressful.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, in some cases, they were breaking messages that told the whereabouts and the fate of their own brother's ships and their boyfriend's ships. I mean, the women were very, very aware that lives were at stake and that the lives of the men that they loved were in their hands, so to speak.
Talk about pressure. Well, and I remember, again, from the movie about Enigma, there is a moment in that movie where one of the young code breakers realizes that, you know, that his brother's ship is going to be targeted. But the group in that movie, at least, you can't protect every single ship or the enemy will know that you've gotten the code. So did that happen with these women, too, where they knew something was coming, but they couldn't reveal their hand too openly?
You know, I talked to historians about whether this really happened, that we would know that there was going to be an attack and we wouldn't warn the ship.
You had
and
to
I
let
have
it
to
happen,
say,
yeah.
Yeah, I must say, historians that I talked to were skeptical that really happened. So that may have been an over-dramatization. I can't say for sure, but I can say what happened to one of the women in my book is that she was the naval watch officer, because these women became naval officers when they broke a message saying that her brother's ship was about to be targeted by kamikaze. They did let the Navy know, but of course there was nothing they could do to stop a kamikaze attack, and the ship was attacked.
Right. All right. Lots more stories after a short break, and we'll talk about what you just touched on there, Liza, that eventually during the war, women were officially admitted into the military, some of them as waves in the Navy. We'll hear a lot more about that after a short break, and let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're hearing about the thousands of young American women who became codebreakers in World War II, translating intelligence used in battles from Midway to D-Day. Our guest is author Liza Mundy, and her book is called Code Girls. Let's get your questions and comments in about this fascinating slice of our history. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Liza, so many important moments in the war where the work that these women did played an incredibly important role. But what were some of the key battles that these female codebreakers' work really made a difference?
Well, of course, one of the most famous battles that turned on our ability to break the Japanese naval fleet code was the Battle of Midway. And that was an enormously important sea battle, one of the most famous sea battles of all time. And that occurred in June of 1942, about, 6 months after Pearl Harbor. The Japanese had, they had wanted to completely destroy our Pacific fleet with a Pearl Harbor attack. And they failed because our aircraft carriers were out of the harbor and we were able to restore some of our battleships. So in June of 1942, the Japanese set out to finish us off, basically, and to ambush our fleet. And by then, we were reading the Japanese naval fleet code, which we hadn't been able to do right before Pearl Harbor because the Japanese had changed some of their code books. And so we were able to read the messages in which, and to know that this ambush was in the making, and we were able to have our ships and planes positioned to repel the Japanese and to basically ambush the enemy. And we won the Battle of Midway, a 3-day sea battle. It was enormously important. It wasn't yet, I think, a complete tipping point in the war, but it was a beginning of a tipping point. It was just massively important. And the reason that we were able to break that code system was because a schoolteacher named Agnes Driscoll had spent the better part of the 1930s diagnosing how the Japanese naval fleet code worked and coming to truly understand that very, very difficult, what was called a super enciphered code system. And she had trained the American naval officers who were out in the Pacific working that code system on site. She was an enormously important pioneer whose work then led to the recruitment. In part, it was her work who led to the recruitment of thousands and thousands of more women during the war. So that's one example. I mean, that's one of the most famous code-breaking victories of World War II. There were many, many other examples.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about them. But this Midway battle, it is incredible. It was a decisive victory. It was very important. As you said, just 6 months after Pearl Harbor. Set the scene for us in those, sort of stuffy code-breaking rooms, Liza. What was it like for these women knowing that they had figured it out, that that ambush was coming, and that they were going to stop it?
Yes. And so the Battle of Midway was mostly being worked by men in the Pacific who had been trained by Agnes Driscoll, and the women from the Seven Sisters were pouring into Washington in June of 1942.
It's still early in this
and
effort.
Right,
yeah.
And so they're coming in exactly at the moment when we understand for the first time just how important code breaking is going to be to World War II, to the winning of World War II. And they're coming in. The naval headquarters are so crowded that the women are having to sit on upturned wastebaskets. they're scrambling for places to stay. So they're coming in as this is becoming clear. But just to talk about one other, less than a year later, when the women are all fully in place, another major sort of payback moment in the Pacific War is when messages come down saying that Admiral Yamamoto, who was the commander of the Japanese Navy and the mastermind of Pearl Harbor, would be making an inspection tour of the Solomon Islands. And the women now are fully in place, and they get to work on the messages that basically announces what his itinerary is going to be.
Wow.
And there are men in the Pacific working it as well. They work together very closely, the women in Washington, the men in the Pacific, and they put together his itinerary down to basically the nanosecond, so we know when he's going to be in the air, when he's going to be on a minesweeper, when he's going to be back up in the air. And the decision is made to shoot his plane out of the air, basically assassinate an enemy leader. And the women remembered that cheering went up in the code-breaking compound when they learned that the admiral's plane had been shot out of the air. This was a top secret effort. And it was successful, you know, and the women knew that the consequences of their work was that ships are being sunk, lives are being lost, enemy commanders were being killed. And, you know, and as I said, there was cheering. I mean, it was war. And there was no second guessing of the work that they were doing.
Well, I want to ask you in a minute, Liza, about a very chatty Japanese military leader, Oshima, who's, you know, did a lot of talking. And that was very helpful for these code breakers. But let's go to our listeners, too, and their questions. Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Tom in Exeter just says, terrific guest, very interesting topic. Tom, thank you so much. The topic is fascinating. Kate and two other people sent this email correcting me, and I really appreciate it. Kate says, the formerly all-women's colleges that you referenced were not all in Massachusetts. Radcliffe, now part of Harvard, Smith, Mount Holyoke, and Wellesley colleges are. Vassar, now co-ed, and Barnard are in New York, and Bryn Mawr is in Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for the correction. I really appreciate it, Kate and the other people who sent that in. Let's take a call. This is Ray in Londonderry. Hi, Ray. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Fascinating topic. Just wanted to say, well, two things. One is Battle of Midway was an incredible victory, and my father's ship there, Yorktown, was sunk there, but it was 35 U.S. ships against 125 Japanese ships, and the code breakers enabled an ambush. They knew exactly where the fleet was going, and it wouldn't have been impossible without the code breaking effort.
Wow.
But the second thing I just wanted to say, and I'll listen for a comment off the air, I worked in intelligence over a military career, and I spent 3 years at the national level at the Coast Guard's National Intelligence Center, and was able to go back into some archives because I had an interest. That was the late 80s. But I kept some of my stuff that was unclassified. And in 1998, an article I wrote about the code breakers. And heading the code breakers effort for the Coast Guard, which was integrated in the Navy during the war, was Elizabeth Freedman, who had been working there since the days of Prohibition. Well, I was able to discover through her efforts, they broke the Abwehr Code, which is the German Secret Service Code, mainly from intercepts and decoding them from Nazi agents in South America and throughout the Western Hemisphere. And so I wrote that article, and Elizabeth Freedman's son called me up and talked about keeping a secret. He said, my mother was always afraid she'd talk in her sleep. But when I asked her what she did in World War II, she always made it sound like she was nothing more than a postal clerk.
My goodness.
And she kept the secret all those years, and even her own son didn't know that she'd broken what was regarded as the most dangerous or the hardest German code to crack. I'd be interested in any comments. I just wanted to say that.
Ray, I'm so happy that you called. What a story. Thank you so much. What do you think, Liza?
Yes, I'm so glad he mentioned Elizabeth Freedman. She was also a very important code-breaking pioneer. She was working the rum runner codes during Prohibition, during the during the period of Prohibition, and then just as he said, she went to work for the Coast Guard during World War II. So along with Agnes Driscoll and a couple other women, she was doing important, very important work even during the war. And what he said about, you know, women being told to say that they were postal clerks, this is so important. The women in my book were told that if anybody asked what they did at these giant compounds in Washington, D.C., they were to say that they were secretaries, basically, that they did unimportant, trivial work, that they emptied waste baskets, they sharpened pencils. And because they were women, people believed it. And so in that sense, women were the ideal intelligence officers at the time, because people believed that their work necessarily had to be trivial and unimportant.
Well, Ray, thank you so much for that call. Again, our number for you to join us, like Ray did, 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email. That'd be great, too, exchange@nhpr.org. So at what point, Liza, do these female Navy codebreakers, we'll talk about the Army in a little bit, but the Navy women, at what point were they allowed to become sort of full Navy, official military staff?
Right. They were recruited in, you know, in the very late winter of 1941, early 1942. And then in the middle part of 1942, the military really starts wrestling with the prospect of admitting women into the military. And there's a big push to create the WAVES, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service, to get women fully into the Navy. And this is a big strategic battle on the part of leaders of these women's colleges that you mentioned. They were very savvy leaders for women's rights. They understood that the war was a chance for women to prove their leadership ability. There was a lot of conversation about women's leadership to open up fields to women. So they hammered on the door of the U.S. Navy and persuaded the Navy to admit women fully into the U.S. Navy, not even as an auxiliary. And it was a long and important battle. The Navy at first didn't want the women to be able to wear navy blue. They wanted the women's uniforms to be khaki or gray. And the leaders of women's colleges understood that it was important that the women fully look like, enlisted women or officers in the case of the female college graduates. So in 1942, the women who had initially been recruited as civilians would go back to officer training school, and they would be trained as naval officers. And then women who hadn't had the benefit of a college education would be allowed to enlist in the U.S. Navy, you know, and go in as ordinary seamen, so to speak. And so this was a big, big moment when women all over the country would enlist in the U.S. Navy to serve the war effort. They would be given aptitude tests. And if they did well on certain parts of the test, they would be routed into the code-breaking effort as well. And so women were on troop trains coming from California, coming from Oklahoma, all of them converging on Washington, D.C. and living together in barracks.
Well, our producer, Christina Phillips, found this 7 or 8 minute newsreel where the government, you know, promotes the WAVES and look how wonderful they are and look at all the things that they're doing. And some of it, you know, sounds a little funny to modern ears, like, don't eat too many potatoes, girls, you know. That kind of thing. But I want to play a little bit now, Liza, because in this bit that we're going to hear, there is a hint that these women will be involved in some type of communication, although, of course, code breaking isn't mentioned. Let's hear.
Soon these girls will be communicating with the whole world, from Washington to the South Pacific and the Mediterranean, encircling the globe, contacting warships in far-off combat zones. They study operation of the radio direction finder with its characteristic loop. The dial indicates the direction from which the radio signal comes. It is used for aviation and sea navigation.
Again, that's a newsreel from the World War II era describing the work of the WAVES, this new generation of military women. How did the government, Liza, try to present this kind of new idea to an American public that might have been somewhat skeptical?
Right. And, you know, there was a lot of skepticism about women in the military. And there was, there was some thinking that women joining the military were bad girls. And so women had to overcome some stigma. But in those wonderful newsreels that you played, it's true that, you know, in addition to the code breaking work, which was communications work, there were also women doing essentially cybersecurity. They were encoding our messages, our military messages that we were sending. And there were also women doing work that wasn't secret, in which they were working as Morse code operators or, you know, working in air traffic radio control towers. So they were doing all sorts of communications work, some of which was overt. And this was important. I mean, the receiving of Morse code or working in air traffic control towers, you know, there were a lot of sort of biases against women, right, obviously. And so there was thinking that women's voices were too soft to be heard if they were working in a radio control, you know, an air traffic control tower. Or there was a concern that women would become hysterical in an emergency if planes were coming in or if they had to work as Morse code operators. So in so many venues, women proved, you know, that their voices were audible, that they wouldn't collapse, you know, in an emergency or a crisis. And a lot of the work they were doing during the war was in various aspects of communications.
Let's take another call. This is Louise in Warwick, Massachusetts. Hi, Louise. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for a great show.
Good.
So my question is, if they were doing this in secret, couldn't tell what they were doing, what were their salaries, and how did that relate to the significance of their work?
Thank you so much, Louise, for the question. And I think you looked at this, Liza.
Yes. Well, you know, ironically enough, their salaries were it was government work, so they weren't luxurious, but they were better. The salaries were often better than what the women had been making, particularly women who had been school teachers. Now, of course, a lot of these women were coming straight out of college, and they had never made money before anyway, so any pay looked good. And they were too busy to even spend their paychecks, they often remembered. But the women who had been actually were recruited having as school teachers were often making about, my central character was making $900 a year as a school teacher in Southern Virginia. And she was able to make $1,600 a year when she was hired by the War Department to sink those Japanese supply ships. And, you know, they might get raises to the point where they were making $2,000 a year. And to them, that was pretty good money.
Well, Louise, thank you so much for the question. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. So, Liza, a moment ago we talked about how when some of these female codebreakers became full members of the U.S. Navy, people started to look again at their roles and so forth. And sometimes because the military has a pretty hierarchical structure, people didn't really know what to do with women who were rising up through that structure. So give us a little bit more there, please, Liza. It was not always easy.
No, I mean, I uncovered documents in which they were having top naval officers were having weekly meetings trying to figure out, can we teach these women to shoot? What is, if these women are actually, you know, with having men working in their units, what's their commanding sort of authority over men? And sometimes the women didn't have full commanding authority over the men who were working for them. But decisions we've made on the fly, like, yeah, we got a pistol range. Let's teach them how to shoot. Because they did have, you know, they did have guns and on their desks in the code-breaking compound. And there was always the fear that, you know, an enemy agent might break in. So the women were taught how to shoot. But, you know, what was also interesting is that they were repeatedly tested to see if they could keep a secret. Again, the fear that they might blab. One of the women I interviewed had this wonderful memory that she was walking up Wisconsin Avenue to the Naval Codebreaking Compound, and there was a rule during the war that you should give a member of the military a ride if they were walking along the street, because, you know, gas was rationed and cars were scarce, and it was raining. And she remembered being offered a ride by a man and his wife who were driving up Wisconsin Avenue, and the man had a raincoat on, and she gratefully accepted. And during the ride, he quizzed her on the work that she did. And the women had a patch. It was called a Q patch. And they were called Specialist Q. And so, you know, he said, what do you do in that compound? She said, oh, I'm just a secretary. I just do this and that. I fill ink wells, whatever. And he said, what does that Q patch stand for? What does Specialist Q mean? And she didn't have a script for this, so she just had to sort of improvise. And she said, well, it's Q for communications. You know, the Navy can't spell. She just laughed it off. And when she got out of the car, he reached over to open the door, and he sort of hiked up his raincoat, and she saw all these gold bars, and she realized that it was a naval admiral.
Wow.
And that he had been testing her to see if she could basically, you know, keep a secret, and she passed.
All right. Well, a lot more of our conversation with Liza Mundy in just a moment, and we'll hear about the role these women codebreakers played in the Normandy invasion in June 1944. All that plus your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Become an NHPR sustainer today for a chance to win a trip to the white sand beaches of Captiva Island, Florida. You'll also be entered to win our grand prize, a trip for two to Barcelona, Spain, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. Enjoy 6 days perusing the Museo Picasso or taking in a flamenco show at Los Torantos, Barcelona. You'll be automatically entered to win both trips when you sustain the news you trust and the programs you love right now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, artificial intelligence. What it is, how it's developing, and what it might mean for our lives. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're hearing the untold story of the women codebreakers of World War II, whose code cracking played a role in many key battles. And we've been hearing from you, your questions, your family's stories. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And our guest is Liza Mundy. We're looking at her book called Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Liza joins us from D.C. And Liza, we've been talking about how many of these female codebreakers became official members of the U.S. military, the Navy, under a group called the WAVES. I want to play a little bit more from a government newsreel about the WAVES. This just was, again, trying to soften up the American public about these women are okay, they're still women, they still look sharp. Here's a little bit more from the government, just describing the fitness and preparedness of the WAVES.
It is important for Uncle Sam to have the girls fit. Well, they've a man-sized job to handle, so they've got to be trim and strong. Yo, heave-ho, my lassies. That's one way to keep the waistline down. Body conditioning is prescribed for the entire personnel in the Navy, from Admiral to Blue Jacket. And now, the WAVES.
So, okay, you couldn't see it because we're on the radio, but they're basically staying fit and trim there. Heave-ho, lassies. What about that, Liza? Sort of the military trying to have it both ways. Like, yes, they're doing really important jobs. We can't quite tell you what those jobs are, but they're important. But they're still female.
Oh, absolutely. There's so much to unpack in what you just played. You notice also that they're referred to as girls. Their job is man-size, but they're girls. Well, you know, of course, they're women, but inevitably women at this time were referred to as girls. And yes, there was this emphasis on looks. Again, the Navy, they wanted the American public to understand, just as you say, that they were still women, but also that they were, quote unquote, good girls, that they were, you know, upright and circumspect. And so there was a lot of scrutiny on these women. But, you know, I will say also that the women were very, very happy at what a good job the Navy did ultimately with their uniforms. They had designer uniforms that were really smashing. And some of the women joined the WAVES specifically because they liked the uniforms, or that was part of the appeal. And you know, the Army created the WACS during this period, the Women's Army Corps.
Right, let's not forget about those, them.
Right, and very important. And their uniforms were khaki, and of course the or maybe olive drab. And the of course there's competition between the Army and the Navy, and the Navy women liked to say that the Army women also had to wear khaki underwear, and they were very proud that they did not have sort of designated uniform underwear.
Well, it's great to hear that historical footage of, you know, way to go, lassie. So,
it sure is.
Let's take another call, Liza. This is Laurel in New Boston. Hi, Laurel. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Liza. My mother was a codebreaker during the war. She was from North Carolina. She had a master's in math from Duke, and she was teaching in Lynchburg, Virginia. And she said she had done it, but I never found stuff. But after she died, I was going through stuff, and I found a certificate she got as thanks. She actually said she didn't want to join the military, and she didn't. And she went on to design helicopters at Piesecki Aircraft.
Wow.
After that, but in the later part of the war. But
can I ask you a question, Laura?
Sure.
So you said that she said she did it, so she told you, but it doesn't sound like she told you a lot.
No, she didn't tell me very much, and I'm kind of sorry that I didn't pump her for more information. But it was sort of, and I think in the later years I could have.
Yeah.
But you know, when I first knew about it, you know, it was sort of like, you know, she just said, yeah, I did code breaking during the war.
Wow.
And you know, it wasn't a big deal. She said the reason she was selected, she said, because I had the math background, and because I was a third generation American.
Well, Laurel, thank you so much for the call. Really good to hear from you. I know you heard from a lot of children of these women, Liza. You know, I never really understood or appreciated what my mom did.
Exactly. And let me just say that the caller's mother exactly fits the profile of the women recruited, particularly by the U.S. Army, which was competing with the Navy. So the Army turned to the South in many cases, and it turned to school teachers, you know, these incredibly well-educated women who mostly worked as civilians, didn't join the military because that's how the Army preferred to do it. So again, my central character was also from Lynchburg, Virginia, and she was teaching school when she was recruited to do this work. So a very, very typical trajectory. These women were so excellent to have attained a college degree at a time in American life when only 4% of American women had a four-year college degree. And to have a master's degree like that, you know, she was clearly so excellent. And again, these women kept the secret for decades and decades. My central character had two younger brothers who survived the war. And those men, after the war, had jobs involving top security clearances. And they would get together and brag about their security clearances. And she could never tell them that she had also had a top secret security clearance. So that's what the women had to put up with. And in many cases, very late in life, they might, you know, after decades of not getting credit, knowing that basically the story's out, that movies like The Imitation Game are out, the women would, you know, drop a statement like that. Well, you know, I did code breaking work, but they wouldn't say more than that. And the caller should know that she can try to obtain her mother's personnel records, and it can be very rich and satisfying to do so. I have a website, lizamundy.com, and there's a tab called Resources for Codebreakers and Families. You can look at that because it's pretty easy to get a military or a civilian personnel record from during the war. And just as you say, I have heard from hundreds and hundreds of families who say, oh, so my mother wasn't a secretary during the war.
Oh, Laurel, it's really good to hear from you. So here's an email from Mike in Keene, who says, for a number of years, I worked at American University in D.C. I was always fascinated by a decrepit old storage building we used across from the entrance on Wisconsin Avenue. Being a veteran, I recognized the building as typical of World War II era construction, special service recreation facilities, and wondered what its role might have been in the past. Mike says, over time, I came to realize that there was also what appears to be an intelligence gathering compound nearby. This is not far from where I believe the Japanese ambassador's residence was located. I believe that this decrepit old building might have been some sort of facility that housed code breakers or some of their activities. Does this sound familiar? Can you shed some light on this facility and its role in code breaking? And Liza, if you can't shed light on that particular building that Mike asks about, you do write a lot about the buildings that were sort of put up very quickly to house these women and the work they were doing.
Sure. And he's exactly right. There were a lot of what they call temporary buildings. So there were a lot of buildings constructed during the war, both, you know, to house the people doing this work and then to give them a place to live. So many of our garden apartment buildings that are still in Arlington or in Virginia or in Washington, D.C. were built to house these women who were pouring into Washington. And then these temporary structures were built so they could work there. And then, you know, the government being what it is, they often weren't torn down right away. And people would just continue to work in them. But I think the facility he may be talking about in Northwest Washington on Nebraska Avenue, there was a girls' school, a very elite young women's high school, Mount Vernon Seminary. A lot of daughters of senators and ambassadors were in school there. The Navy needed a big, secure compound for its code-breaking operations, so it kicked those girls out. They were forced to take classes in Garfinkel's department store, and it moved its code-breaking operation in. It's right across the street from American University, and it still exists. You can still see the Naval Chapel where the women were told they'd be shot if they talked about the work that they did. That was their welcome to Washington, basically.
Wow.
You can see the big brick buildings they worked in, and that is now where the Department of Homeland Security is headquartered. So that compound is very much still there.
Well, and in reference to Laurel's comment about her mother and how little she really knew, you mentioned your website, Liza. I just want to let our listeners know that we've got resources, including Liza's website, on ours, nhpr.org/exchange. Again, nhpr.org/exchange. Let's go to Kathy in Concord, Liza. And Kathy, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura and Liza. Thank you for taking my call. What a great show. I had just finished reading your book and went to London. And we were able to go into the Churchill War Rooms. Very basic place. And the main office in that room where the war was basically fought, with like three desks, two or three phones, and a huge map with red pins all over it.
Mm.
And had I not read the book, I would have thought, how could you win a war with this, you know, basic equipment?
Right.
But I knew how important the women were in fighting the war. And then I went to Normandy a few days later. And it really, really hit home how much the women had done to help win the war.
Kathy, I'm so glad you called.
Win the battle.
Yeah, because I visited those museums and beaches last year and had the same reaction you did. I mean, it's just, you're just awestruck when you're there. And you're right. You appreciate the role that the Codebreakers played. I'm so glad you called, Kathy, because I did want to ask you, Liza, what you learned in writing this book about the role Codebreakers played in D-Day, the Normandy invasion that Kathy mentions, that really kind of spelled the beginning of the end for Nazi Germany. So what role did they play there? You said earlier the Brits were really in charge of the Atlantic, but I know the Americans played a role as well.
So this is so important. Women were so important in so many ways. So the Brits were in charge of the Battle of the Atlantic and that code breaking in the Atlantic when we joined the war. But we were the junior partner, and we eventually really took over the Atlantic code breaking from the British. And of course, they were concentrating in many other venues. But and the Germans were using this Enigma machine that people have heard of if they've seen The Imitation Game, a sort of a typewriter-like machine that scrambled German messages. And we became really the lead entity in breaking those messages in the Atlantic Ocean. And as a result of that, the Atlantic Ocean was cleared of the U-boat threat, which was enormous, the wolf packs of German submarines. And so we were able to send the massive convoys across the Atlantic that were necessary to mount the D-Day invasion, right? All the men, all of the material to support that invasion had to be sent by ship. And so that was one part of it, was you know, clearing the U-boat menace. Women also created what was called dummy traffic. So we wanted to persuade the Germans that if we invaded, we were going to invade in a different part of the coast of France. And so they created fake military traffic to persuade the Germans that we had troops, that the Allies had troops massed to invade Calais. So that was another part of the effort. But the most important part, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the show or earlier in the show, we had broken the separate code system, cipher system, that the Japanese diplomats were using who were stationed in Europe. So there were Japanese diplomats stationed in Germany, stationed in all of the occupied countries, all the Axis countries, and they were dutifully sending very detailed messages back to Tokyo. And we had broken that machine cipher thanks to a woman, another pioneer named Genevieve Grochin, who before we entered the war had the key insight that enabled us to break that system, even though nobody in the Allied effort had ever even seen that Japanese machine. So we were reading these dispatches, and one of the most important was a dispatch in which the Japanese diplomats had been invited to tour the coast of France, Hitler's vaunted Atlantic Wall, protecting the coast of France from an Allied invasion. And they dutifully reported back to Tokyo on where the coast of France was well fortified and where it was not, so that we knew when we were planning the invasion that Normandy was the best spot to invade. So that shows you in how many different ways the women contributed to D-Day.
So after the war is over, of course, everyone's happy. The U.S. government says to these women, thank you very much for your service. Good job. Don't tell anyone.
Yes, exactly.
And now go home and, you know, go back to being wives and mothers or join that role if you hadn't done that before. Here's an example that we came up with, our producer Christina Phillips found, from a company called Jack and Heinz Company, known as Jocko in Cleveland. This company made airplane parts during the war, and here's what the company told its women to do now that the war was over.
Each returning serviceman will get his job back when this war is won. And you women and girls will go home, back to being housewives and mothers again, as you promised to do when you came to work for us. If all industry would adopt this simple policy of taking care of their own employees, there would be no serious post-war problem of unemployment.
Okay, so that's from a private company, but the government kind of said the same thing, right, Liza? You women and girls will go home as you promised.
Absolutely. And that's what an amazing, go home as you promised. Yes. And that was the message that the government sent as well. The women received letters thanking them for their service. The Navy women received medals. They were told never to show them to anybody and basically said, yep, you know, this was the deal. So go back home. And most of them did. And one of the incredibly moving aspects of my reporting, you know, I interviewed more than 20 of these women. They had to live with this secret for the rest of their lives. A group of naval enlisted women remained such close friends, and their friendship was so sustaining to them, even as they couldn't talk about what they had done, that they started something called a round robin letter. It was basically a chain letter, a group chain letter that they sent to each other. And that chain letter kept going for 75 years.
Oh, wow.
And when I was doing my reporting, two of the women were still alive, and they were writing to each other almost every day. So that's how important their friendships were. One of the women in that friendship group, her email sign-on, her name is Ruth Mirsky. Her email sign-on is Ruth the Wave. That's her email address. So it shows how important her naval service remained to her for the rest of her life, even as she couldn't talk about it. So that was, you know, that was sort of their lot. But it's also important to say that there was a cohort of women who didn't go home, who stayed with the work, who went to work for what became the NSA. And one of the first female deputy director of NSA, Ann Kara Christie, was recruited during the war. So they really pioneered the presence of women in intelligence. And there was a group of women who stuck with it and were crucial during the Cold War.
Well, Liza, we could have talked for another hour. I really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you so much.
It was a wonderful discussion. Thank you for having me.
That's Liza Mundy, author of several best-selling books, including the one we talked about today, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.